You're listening to The Dirt on the Past, a show on history and archaeology and why it matters today. You can find us on the Extreme History Project website and also on kgbm.org. Thanks for listening. Welcome to The Dirt on the Past from the Extreme History Project and KGBM Community Radio.
Whether digging up a site or dusting off the archives, we bring you some of the most fascinating and cutting-edge research in history and archaeology, and discuss why it matters today. Join me, Nancy Mahoney, alongside co-host Crystal Alegria, as we converse with anthropologists, archaeologists,
and historians about how they bring the past alive.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we are the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. This week, we are at the Extreme History Headquarters, and today we are discussing the historical context of the show, 1883, which is the prequel to the wildly popular series Yellowstone. So we're excited to discuss the series, but first, I want to check in. Crystal, how was your week?
It was a really good week. We did some fundraising this week. So as a nonprofit, we're always fundraising. But this week we did some fun fundraising. We did a fundraiser at the local brewery, Bozeman Brewing, and they call it Sunday Fun Day. And so we went in yesterday on Sunday, and all beers that are bought during a certain time period of that day, 10% of that goes back to the Extreme History Project. So
That's great. Yeah. That is a fun fundraiser. I missed it.
I know. Sorry you missed it too, but it was fun.
Yes.
We had a good time.
I was planning to be there and then had to cover a shift for one of my folks who I think fell off a horse, twisted her ankle so badly, we're not quite sure if it's got a really bad ligament sprain or if there's actually a piece of bone. I'm not going to get into it for our listeners. That's too much. So we're going to hope that she's better.
Yeah.
But it was too bad to miss that. But other than that, my week was good too. And I did spend quite a bit of it getting to do our fun homework for this episode, which was watching the first five episodes of 1883, which has been really fun.
I know. It was fun to dig into this and to really explore it a little bit.
Yeah, and get back to our wheelhouse, sort of the 19th century a little bit. Mm-hmm. So let's get to it.
Okay.
So the series Yellowstone, as most of you know already, is an American drama television series created by Taylor Sheridan and John Linson. And it premiered in June of 2018 on the Paramount Network, although I think now you can watch it on Peacock or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, so the series stars Kevin Costner and Luke Grimes, among others, and it follows the fictional Dutton family, who in the series are owners of the largest cattle ranch in Montana, the Yellowstone Dutton Ranch, commonly called the Yellowstone. And in the series, it borders the national park. So the plot in Yellowstone revolves around family drama at that cattle ranch and in the park, as well as on the bordering Broken Rock Indian Reservation, which is a fictional version based on the Crow Reservation located in southeast Montana. So Yellowstone's fourth season premiered in November of 2021, just a few months ago. And during that time, they gave a little bit of a hint at what was to come, which is the series prequel, 1883. And 1883 follows the origins of the Dutton family on their journey from Texas to Montana. And 1883 is another Taylor Sheridan creation. It dropped its first episode in December of 2021. And Crystal and I have seen all of the first five episodes that are currently out. And so today we thought for our Dirt on the Past episode, we'll share our insights surrounding the historical context of the show, which is indeed set in 1883. And we wanted to sort of look at, from what we know historically about that time period, how the context of the show is portraying it and if there are accuracy issues. So before we jump into that, though, Crystal, let's first start by talking a little bit about Taylor Sheridan himself. and the films he's created. He's done a lot of interviews, so we did have a lot of information on him we could dive into.
Yeah, we watched a lot of his interviews. We read a lot of his interviews, and we got to know the man himself because, of course, he is the screenwriter for 1883 and for Yellowstone and a few other movies that we found out.
Yes, so I know he did Sicario, which I have seen. That was a while ago. Okay. And
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, a lot of his movies, as we've discussed, have a lot of violence in them. So yeah. For me, unless they're about a particular topic that I'm interested in, it's not necessarily on the top of my list. I went to see Sicario with my husband, and it was very violent, but I think it was about drug cartels, and I think Emily Blunt was in it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
yeah.
But more closer afield to the topic today are Hell and High Water and Wind River, both movies that we have seen. Mm-hmm. And Wind River is the film that follows the sort of bigger issue of missing and murdered indigenous women. And it's set on the Wind River Indian Reservation, which is in Wyoming, and it follows the case of one particular young woman and the efforts to understand and prove who murdered her or who caused her death and murdered someone else. And a really good film, a really sensitive portrayal to the family and the groups on the Wind River Reservation. And that got a lot of critical acclaim.
Right.
And then Hell or High Water, which I think you watched just recently. Tell a little bit about that.
So that's a show about two brothers who become bank robbers, basically to pay their mortgage of their family ranch in Texas. And so it is very much a land issues film, and I really liked it. It was, to me, it was a really good portrayal of these, you know, working class men trying to family members trying to make it in this world. And of course the bank is the big villain.
The bank is the bad guy, the villain in that
film. Yeah. But it also has a sheriff played by Jeff Bridges who is also in the film and is in a starring role.
And a little more
kind of
sensitive
antagonist
portrayal of that aspect of authority. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Wind River, again, you get a law enforcement person who's sort of the good guy, one of the heroes of the story. And the oil industry, or those sort of extracting resources off the public lands or the reservation, they tend to be the evildoers in Wind River.
Mm-hmm.
So just that gives us a little bit of a background on Taylor Sheridan. We know he's also been an actor and has starred in Sons of Anarchy and has had some other roles himself as an actor, but he really has moved behind the camera and onto the page. And he talks a lot about how he wants to portray the West and portray Native Americans and understand sort of these struggles through a different perspective. So we've read several things about him, and one of the quotes he talks about is, issues afflicting Indian country, saying it at the Cannes Film Festival in 2017 that there's nothing he can do to change those issues. He says, quote, "But what we can do as artists and must do is scream about them with fists clenched. What we can do is make sure these issues aren't ignored." So it seems that he is often on a mission, and one of his things is to have a more realistic or sensitive portrayal of tribes, Native Americans, people living in Indian country.
Right. Yeah, and he's talked about that in a lot of the interviews that he gives. He talks about his dedication and his commitment to tribal nations, to portray them, how they haven't been portrayed before in films and on, you know, in series like his series that he's created with Yellowstone.
Mm. All right, so let's get to it, Crystal. Let's start with first reactions and what we liked about 1883. So start off with your first reactions, Crystal. What were your thoughts?
Well, the beauty of the series is pretty spectacular. You know, it's filmed all on location, outside, on the ground. And so far, we've seen mainly views of Texas.
Right.
But the way that this film is shot, it's just gorgeous. Mm. And, you know, the landscape definitely becomes a character right from the very, very beginning.
Absolutely.
And so you can really see that. And the characters in the beginning are taking that all in, too, and really loving the scenery and loving the environment that they're in. But you as a viewer really are immersed in that landscape and that beautiful landscape. So that to me was pretty amazing how he shot this whole thing on location. Cattle herds and all. Cattle herds, a wagon train of
animals,
like 30
wagons. Yeah, it was impressive. And horses, again, I think the themes, you know, same in Wind River, same in Hell or High Water, the land seems to be a character and an important aspect, the environment in general. And it is definitely beautifully portrayed. I would definitely agree with you about that.
Yeah, it's kind of shot on an epic scale, you know. I mean, you kind of think of course, Lonesome Dove, that kind of really comes into your mind when you're seeing this, because that was that was shot in a very similar way.
Right, yeah. Right. I'm sure Yellowstone is too. I haven't seen as much of that series, but that whole idea of the landscape itself as being such a central part of the story, a central feature, and enjoying the beauty of it and sort of explaining and exploring, though, that it's a double-edged sword, because there's also a lot of dangers and perils that are always associated with these Western landscapes.
Right.
And so that kind of brings us to my reaction to the very first opening scene, which starts with a narration of Elsa, who's basically the central character, I believe, the protagonist in this series. So she's a young woman. She's the daughter in the Dutton family. She's 18 years old. And she narrates the very first scene where we see her waking up on the ground, clearly in distress. And as we pan back from that, we see that she is in a very violent scene where a group of Native Americans on horseback with bows and arrows and tomahawks and face paint and feathers have been slaughtering a whole group of what looks like settlers, pioneers, burning wagons, things like that. And she's on the ground and trying to get a gun and fight back. And she's in this long white dress, face smudged with smoke. And there's a lot of questions that aren't answered in that scene, because from that we then flash all the way back to whatever time period happened before that. So we don't know if that's going to be this series ends. But right away, I feel like the very first scene looks stereotypically like a Western, an older Western. Native Americans on horseback, very othered. I'm not sure in 1883 that they were still using bows and arrows
as their main, especially in this sort of scenario, which there's obviously a battle that had just happened.
Yes.
And so you'd think that they would be using their firearms, which they had in abundance at this point.
So
that was a little jarring.
Because a lot of the battles, Little Bighorn, others, Native Americans were already fighting with guns, and they had acquired ammunition. Yeah. So that was a little puzzling for the time period, which made us wonder at first if it really was 1883.
Right.
But yes.
We kind of thought it might have been 20 years before, 20 years earlier. But it is, you know, supposed to be 1883.
Right. We're not sure why Elsa is in this fancy, beautiful white dress. It almost looks like she could have been out there getting married. Who knows? We don't know the context at all. We don't know who the native people are supposed to be, except that there's an exchange between her and one native man who's on horseback, who is saying, don't reach for that gun, don't do it. And she's yelling, you speak English, how can you possibly speak English? He says, you speak English. And then they argue, and he's saying that he would capture her and sell her. He wouldn't necessarily kill her. And again, we thought, not sure how many captives were taken in the 1880s that could be sold. Where would that happen?
Yeah.
Because Native Americans were all on reservations at that point, and I don't think they were trafficking white people.
Right.
At all by that point.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So that opening scene, you know, as we're going into it, we kind of had a lot of questions. We had, you know, a lot of thoughts and ideas kind of percolating up. But as we got into it, just to kind of come back to some of the things that we loved, that we liked.
Right, because that scene is over.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
quickly we go to the setting of the stage, which takes us to Fort Worth, Texas.
Yeah. So we're in Fort Worth, Texas, and And we are meeting some of the main characters. And so we meet James Dutton, who is one of the main characters, played by none other than Tim McGraw himself.
Yeah, who's married to Faith Hill, and she's on her way to Fort Worth in a train.
Yeah. So the Tim McGraw character is married to the Faith Hill character, who is Margaret Dutton. And her daughter, Elsa, that we spoke about before, are coming to Fort Worth on a train. James Dutton had taken a wagon there with a lot of their worldly goods. And so they meet in Fort Worth, and we meet Margaret Dutton and Elsa again at this point in time. And right off the bat, we learn they're both very powerful, independent women.
Right.
And that I loved, of course.
We like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And we learn that as we go through the series, that they are both very independent thinkers. And even, you know, Margaret is always telling Elsa how to be more of a independent woman and a powerful woman.
And they're strong. The characters are fully formed, it seems. And also, Elsa's really the central character.
Yeah.
Not necessarily James in the same way Kevin Costner is in Yellowstone. She's really doing the narration, and most of the screen time is about her and her experience going forward. And right away, you kind of get that sense, how they really are focusing on her on the train, and we're kind of seeing the experience through her eyes and hearing a lot of it through her voice. We do zoom in on all these other characters, but I think you and I felt like that was a nice turn by Taylor Sheridan to make a young woman the central character and have that version. Now, granted, it's still a young white woman, but it's a different take on understanding the West. So we definitely liked that. We also liked, interestingly, some of the other characters. There are the two, I don't know if you'd call them scouts, but the two men that are hired to take a group to the Oregon Trail, or at least up to Oregon from Fort Worth. And in this case, it's a group of immigrants that they take. So Sam Elliott is one of the men who plays a former Civil War captain.
Union.
Yeah. And then another Union soldier whose name is Thomas. I don't have the actor's name.
His name is LaMonica.
Oh, yeah, that's right, from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he is has a nice fully formed role as well. He is sort of the more level-headed of these two men. He's sort of the voice of reason, has a bigger picture. He still wears his jacket from his Civil War days, his uniform. But he gets a chance to voice his memories of what it was like to be a slave before the Civil War. And so we like that that is not ignored in this in this show, that even though we're set in 1883, Civil War ended 1865, that there's still this remembrance and the presence of that event, and it's still such a part of forming who he was as a character.
Right. His name was Thomas, like we said, and he was played by LaMonica Garrett. And so and he talks about growing up enslaved during his role, and that's an important part that we don't often hear in Westerns, especially older Westerns.
Right. Mm-hmm. You've pointed out that it's a little bit like the black character that's in Lonesome Dove.
Yeah.
And so there are a few aspects of including a token black cowboy, sort of.
Right.
In this case, though, I think at least tying this to the Civil War and giving him a bit of a meatier role in terms of the voice he has and the voice of reason he has in this sort of violence and stuff that's going on all around them, I think that was a nice effort at least to have that perspective.
He kind of symbolizes two things. He symbolizes a person who was enslaved until the Civil War, and now he's kind of living his life as a free person. But then he also symbolizes the black cowboy, which there were so many black cowboys at this time in the West. And so he's really kind of doing double duty in that role, in that character. Unfortunately, he's the only black member of this cast.
So far.
That we've seen so
and
far.
And we hope that he continues to have a role in the next five episodes that we'll watch after this.
Right.
Both men have some PTSD, yeah. we would call it now, from the Civil War, especially Sam Elliott's character. And he definitely has, well, he's also lost his family to smallpox epidemic. So he has a lot going on, not super stable emotionally in this, but he is a central character as well.
And I think that one thing that I also liked about this is how the Taylor Sheridan did show the PTSD that all these characters have, because they all were involved in the Civil War. Even Margaret Dutton has PTSD from being a nurse in the Civil War.
Right.
And she, and that comes out. And then it also comes out that the character James Dutton was a captain, a Confederate captain in the Civil War. So you have Shay Brennan, who is the Union captain, and then who was played by Sam Elliott, and then you have the Confederate captain. Mm. And they break down emotionally quite often based on this PTSD from the Civil War. And this is, like you said, Nancy, 20 years later, but they're still, of course, affected. And of course, today, we're still seeing effects of the Civil War. So of course, just 20 years in is not very long at all. And so I'm so glad that he brought this in, because I think that's such an important part of history that we kind of box up the Civil War and put it in a box and say, okay, it was from 1862 to 1865, it was done. And, you know, we don't talk about it.
And then Reconstruction happened in the South, yeah. and then that's it. We don't really realize the West and the impact of that war in the West, and then all of the people that came out who had already been in this country, if they weren't new immigrants, they had all lived through that, and their lives had changed dramatically because of that. And so all of the people out here, Bozeman included, all of these Western states and all of the towns in them, there were people from both the North and the South. There was a lot of slaves who either escaped just before, during, or finally after the Civil War. So it's a very complex demographic landscape out west, not just an actual landscape. And so I think that that's interesting to at least have that enter in a more obvious way in 1883 in the series. So that's been interesting. But we want to talk a little bit about now some of the things that we found were a little bit problematic with the historical context. So there's a lot of things we liked about the series, but there were a lot of things that we felt maybe seemed a little off about the time period and about the way they were portrayed. So some of the issues that we'll dive into are just the date itself, 1883, why Taylor Sheridan picked that date, and maybe why that doesn't jive as well with this event of a group of immigrants trying to get to Oregon, why it started in Fort Worth. This family was from Tennessee, where they had had their home before, during, and after the Civil War. But then 18 years after the Civil War, decide to make this journey. And why did they start it in Fort Worth? How Fort Worth is portrayed, and then how also immigrants are portrayed. So those are the things we want to dive into a little bit more deeply.
Yeah. So, and the reason that we want to do that, why we want to really dive into these things in this historical context of the show, because, you know, historical accuracy is something that Taylor Sheridan talks about wanting to have a high level of historical accuracy in his series and in his films. And of course, we want to always see historical accuracy. We know these are this series is fiction.
We want to get away from the mythologies of the West so people actually understand better our own history. It's a chance through an exciting drama to actually educate along the way. You know, it's kind of like taking these really delicious vitamins instead of choking down something awful.
Right, you know,
and so we love it when there's these opportunities, because it's reaching such a big audience. So it's important, but it's also important not to keep portraying the same myths over and over again so that they seem true.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we're hoping to see about 1883, is what truths are there and what things are we a little disappointed that they might be portraying old myths that really historians have debunked.
Yeah, so we want to kind of myth bust a little bit and then, you know, encourage everybody to watch the rest of the seasons with that idea in mind. It's critical thinking about this, you know, and just kind of looking at these this series with a critical eye.
Right. Which so is it's fun. Too. We're not going to spoil everything. There's a lot we like about the show, but we do want to dive in. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay. So some of the things that we want to dive into is this idea of why it was set in 1883. And so I think that our idea, our theory on this is that Taylor Sheridan kind of set this world up in the series Yellowstone. Not knowing he was going to make an 1883 series. And so then the date was kind of already set, and he kind of had to work around that date, which I think is a little problematic in what he wants to do with 1883, what he wants to do in the series. And so he's kind of had to mesh some history together a little bit.
And that's our going theory here that we're going to unpack. Yeah. So we did a little sleuthing as to why 1883, which interestingly doesn't come up in any of the interviews, but when we went back to the first episode of Yellowstone, Kevin Costner's character says there, the Duttons, every Dutton going all the way back to 1886 has been buried on this land, meaning their ranch. So we know that they had to have been there at least by 1886 and someone died there. So he probably picked a date just a little bit before that.
Yeah.
So we think that he locked himself in based on Yellowstone and then had to run with it. Okay,
right,
that's our going theory.
Yeah.
But we agree that perhaps this maybe wasn't the exact vehicle if you wanted to talk about a journey on the Oregon Trail, right?
And, you know, I think Taylor Sheridan had a love for Lonesome Dove. He talks about that in some of his interviews, that Lonesome Dove was really important to him. And so, you know, if you've seen this series and you've seen Lonesome Dove, you can definitely seen the similarities. So I think he was trying to pull in some of that Lonesome Dove stuff. And so I think that's what some of this, why we see some of the things we see in it. But anyway, let's start off.
Well, let's just first finish that thought, because Lonesome Dove, for people, just to refresh, it's set in the 1870s, but it's about a cattle drive going from Texas, driving longhorns up to Montana.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So, and we have a series of characters along the way. That's where we have, you know, these cowboys, kind of a mishmash of cowboys. Mm-hmm. Now, this book won an award and then it became a film that's watched over and over. So it's kind of, since the 1980s, really sort of set this idea of what cowboy life in the American West was like.
Yeah.
And I think that's a touchstone, right, for so many people. So what we have heard is that the whole idea, Larry McMurtry for the book, sort of loosely based it on a true story about Nelson Story, who is a founding father for Bozeman, here in Montana.
Yeah.
And you know a lot more about him than I do, but what we do know is that in 1863, he went down with some money. He came originally from Ohio, but he picked up supplies along the way, made his way down to Texas.
Well, after he had come to Montana and participated in the gold rush, got some money. He was a teacher before that, so he didn't have a lot of money. So he came here and for the gold rush.
Got his gold.
Went to Virginia City, Montana, and he was one of the lucky ones. He actually struck it somewhat rich.
Yeah.
And he had his wife with him, so he didn't go and spend it all.
See, that's an interesting story.
Yeah, important parts of the story. And so he saved that money, and then he took that money to New York. He traded it. It was $30,000 in gold. And so he traded that $30,000 in gold for greenbacks in New York. And then he went down to Leavenworth, Kansas, and he spent some time there buying goods. And then he went to Texas and he bought some longhorn cattle and drove those up. And so this is the story that Larry McMurtry had heard and based Lonesome Dove off of.
Hmm. And we know Nelson's story. So he hired cowboys, got all the way up here. And that was the days before there were any fences. There were lots of other folks who did that after him in the 1860s and in the 1870s into the early 1880s. And then after a really horrible winter, fences started going up because cattle in a blizzard were dying all over the place because they couldn't be corralled into anywhere with fences. So the open range sort of by
1890s.
Yeah. Yes, by 1890, by late 1880s was closed. So in any event, that's that time frame. So he did it in 1863 or 1864. And then we have Lonesome Dove set in the 1870s, which is historically accurate. But when we're talking about people going out to Oregon on the Oregon Trail, you know, the heyday for that was 1840s, 50s, and 1860s. And then it really drops off for one very important reason.
Mm-hmm.
So by 1863-64, the Transcontinental Railroad is complete going through Utah. The last mm-hmm. Golden Spike is driven in, and so people could get all the way out west in a couple of days. They could save up their money or sell what they had, and in 3 days, very safely and securely, they could make that journey west and then travel other ways from there if they got to California and needed to go to Oregon. But also by the 1880s, the Oregon Trail was such a well-worn trail.
Mm-hmm.
It was very safe. Indians were on reservations everywhere. People weren't being attacked by bandits or marauding Indians. And as we know from history, too, the attacks by Native Americans were few and far between in terms of being any leading cause of death mm-hmm. along the Oregon Trail.
Right.
So this journey across to Oregon would have also gone a very different route. Typically, people started in St. Louis, Missouri.
Or Independence, Missouri.
Yes,
yeah.
And then they picked up supplies and things, and there you'd meet up with other people traveling mm-hmm. out. So you'd go in a large group, and then you would have, in the early days, oxen pulling mm-hmm. the wagons because you could eat them if you needed
right,
to.
Right.
But also they were cheaper, they were plentiful in the 1840s and 50s, and they were very easy. You didn't have to have all these horse training techniques, knowledge. They weren't skitterish like mules. So they were often the favorite animal to yoke up to carry these very heavy wagons, which were often loaded down. So you'd have several teams of oxen, and you would not ride in your wagon. You would be walking alongside. Your wagon would be full of mm-hmm. stuff, and you'd probably pitch tents along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's historically what people have reconstructed. So that's a very different experience than what we're seeing, though, in 1883.
Yeah. Yeah, because this family's from Tennessee. It's not very far. Independence, Missouri is not very far from Tennessee. We don't know exactly
right.
where in Tennessee they were coming from. But Fort Worth, Texas, where they kind of head to first, is a lot. It's about double the distance from Independence, Missouri. So we don't quite understand why they just didn't head up to Independence, get on the
so
Oregon
the train,
Trail and head
the
west.
The train did
yeah.
go up there,
yeah.
too. And,
yeah.
and there's no reason we can surmise that makes sense why in 1883 you would choose to go to Fort Worth. So
yeah.
not only is it farther
yeah.
than Tennessee, it's not the head of a trail to get to Oregon,
mm-hmm.
And specifically for the European immigrants that are the reason the Duttons join along this big caravan, those immigrants, they probably would have entered the country in the Northeast, you know,
yeah.
come through Fort Ellis or something, and they would have headed a totally different route to
Island.
Missouri. Yeah, Ellis Island to Missouri, and then traveled out to Oregon. I'm not sure they would have ever gone down to Texas.
Yeah.
People did go to Texas if they were buying cattle.
Right.
That was,
right.
it was
right.
a cow town, that's right.
Yeah.
But none of those immigrants were buying cattle to
yeah.
take out west. They were
yeah.
just trying to get out with their wagons.
Yeah. And the Dutton family were interested in going west. That was their main, they wanted to go and see what was out there and find a good place to settle. And so, like you said, they had hooked up with these immigrants who the immigrants were definitely headed to Oregon.
To Oregon
they
specifically.
They wanted to go to Oregon.
Right.
And so they kind of were going together. But even, you could even just go to Independence, Missouri, get on the Oregon Trail and then head west and see what was
so
there.
Early on in
yeah,
the series
yeah.
they decide to head west, which
mm-hmm.
takes you into western Texas where it's really dry, and there are people there, it's settled, but they would have to cross a river, and it doesn't get you to Oregon any faster.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we would think if this were historically accurate, they would have just gone north and gone on the trail,
yeah, yeah.
even if they were starting there with wagons. Which
or just take the train.
How did they
the
get there to with
yeah.
wagons? I mean,
yeah.
those immigrants, there's no way they would have traveled to Fort Worth, Texas
mm-hmm.
and brought all that
yeah.
stuff
yeah.
on a train to hop on a wagon. It doesn't
right.
make any sense that we can figure. So it seems like a plot device for sure.
Yes, yes.
The same for the Duttons.
But,
doesn't make sense
yeah,
either.
Yeah.
And the Duttons don't seem to know exactly where they're going, but it seems that James Dutton has a dream.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to be a rancher or a farmer,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to find his own. We don't know exactly. The trailers say fleeing poverty, the Dutton
mm-hmm.
family, but we don't yet know anything about their situation in Tennessee other than that
They had a farm.
He had been in the Confederate Army, but mm-hmm. we don't know if he was living in poverty after. We only know that Elsa's 18 when they head out. So mm-hmm. 18 years after the Civil War ended mm-hmm. is when they decide to leave. So they mm-hmm. stayed for a good long time.
They did.
After.
Tried to make
so a don't know what precipitated yeah. the move all of a sudden. So yeah. there's a few pieces there we're not sure. But the accuracy of why they would be in Fort Worth and how they would be getting on a route to either go west or northwest to Oregon or anywhere else mm-hmm. so far doesn't line up with what we know with what most people would be doing. And so far, Montana isn't on the radar. So yeah, that remains something right. that we'll see in the next few episodes.
Yeah. And they do pick up this cattle herd, much like Lonesome Dove. They right. do pick up a cattle herd kind of as an afterthought.
Yeah, not they don't buy it, though, like Nelson Story did or other cattle drives.
No, they round up some feral cattle yeah. out in the
wild cattle. They just go scare them up pretty yeah. easily. They yeah. get a big herd. Now, again, it wasn't uncommon to have cattle herds following a big long train of wagons. If you were going yeah. on the Oregon Trail, people did do that. Different from driving just cattle to Montana specifically to sell. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes they purposely brought a herd behind so that you did have livestock and things to eat along the way if you didn't want to go off hunting along the way. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, the longer people were out there, the fewer things there were to hunt along the way. So the yeah. bison were gone, mm-hmm. you know, by bison the end of the 1870s and stuff. So they weren't there
yeah.
and the hunting would have been a little thinner. So you could see why that is a good idea.
Yeah.
I don't really know the situation about rounding up feral cattle. So that'll require a little more yeah. historical research, but interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So they talk a lot about the danger, yeah. the incredible danger along the way, of bandits and of Native Americans coming off the right. reservation. So what do we think about that, Crystal?
Well, you know, in 1883, a lot of Native people were living on reservations at that point. And in some cases, they would have to get permission to leave the reservation, written permission from the BIA agent, the agency agent, in charge, they would have to get written permission. And we see these notes giving yeah. people permission to go off the reservation to hunt or to gather wood or to do various things. And so in 1883, that's the case. I don't know if that's the case on all reservations, but definitely a lot of them. So it's kind of interesting to me that they are always, of course, you know, they're always fearful of Native Americans and then these roaming groups of bandits, which they do run into. And so the bandit thing is interesting. And I, you know, there's probably always people out there trying to find people to prey upon. However, but these bandits are very violent.
Very violent. I think the two of us thought also, you know, in the first episode, just in Fort Worth, James Dutton kills four people, bam, 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 and there's no consequences.
No consequences.
There's
yeah.
no law and order, although yeah. we do know there is a sheriff and there is somebody, but yeah. we don't really see anything. And these places have been settled for quite a long time by now. Mm-hmm. And Fort Worth is a big town. Other parts of Texas are settled. I mean, Texas was even independent early on in the 1840s. They were part yeah. of Mexico, then they were independent. Now they're part of the United States. So it's not that this is open wilderness, wild territory. Sure, mm-hmm. there's some open spaces, but there are law and order entities out there. There right. are towns and places. So it seems a little violent and dramatic to us that there's just roving bands of bandits, and also that people can just kill whoever without any
yeah.
consequences whatsoever.
Right. And I think that's one of the mythologies that we want to
yeah.
bust.
Yeah.
Because there was consequences. If you killed people, there was consequences. Even here in Montana in the early days in Virginia City, if you killed someone, you know, there were sheriffs, there were law enforcement entities, and there were trials. There were, I don't know if there were always fair trials, but there were trials. We even had the vigilantes, and
yeah.
there was trials around that. So that is something that,
and
you
know.
And
that was in the 1860s
yeah,
gold
that was
rush.
1860s
I mean, we
gold
know
rush,
that
yes.
the OK Corral, Tombstone, Deadwood, things like that happened in the early 1880s, but that was Southern Arizona on the border. And that was kind of even sort of an organized shootout on the main street, shall we say, over cattle rustling. And then Deadwood is portrayed as a very lawless place, but that's North Dakota. So we're
South Dakota.
Yeah. Sorry. So we're definitely in not where the Duttons are necessarily. Yeah. But I think, again, Sheridan maybe is taking some license with the flavor of these wet. But again, the tropes of the West. It seems that to be a constant threat, and it's very present in all of the episodes. So it's probably a little bit exaggerated, I would say. So let's talk a little bit more about one of our other main concerns regarding the historical accuracy, and that's the portrayal of the immigrants.
Yeah. And I think this is one thing that hit both you and I, Nancy, right off the bat as we were watching the series.
Yeah.
So there's this group of immigrants that the Duttons come in contact with, that Shea Brennan and Thomas are helping guide north onto the Oregon Trail. And this group is a group of, we don't really get a good sense of who they are, but we know they speak German.
And
so we
Italian.
Know they're German, Italian, and we know there are some
Roma who they refer to as gypsies. Exactly. Yeah. And so we know there's at least three different groups. So they said, we don't really know each other. We just came on the boat together.
Yeah.
But they all have decided they want to go to Oregon, which they think of as this promised land, or to Portland. Mm-hmm. And so they hire Shay and Thomas to lead them. And from the very beginning and all the way through these five episodes, all we hear over and over again is how hapless these immigrants are, how they know
nothing,
absolutely nothing. Yeah. They don't know to boil water, that they could get sick from it. They don't know anything about horses. Of course, none of them have firearms, and they've all brought way too much stuff.
And they don't know to be careful of wildlife. They don't. I mean, it goes on and on and on about how ignorant they are about this trip that they're going to be taking. And so that was surprising to us.
That didn't sit quite well with us. And just what our experience has been diving into the history of the West, where pretty much all of these Western towns, at any given time, about a third of the population was foreign-born, so they were immigrants. And we're talking not even including the Chinese in that. So you have a lot of people who immigrated. We know a lot of, for instance, things dealing with medicine, midwifery, birthing babies. All of that knowledge was coming from European midwives, so they knew a lot about healing and those practices. We probably had other, we know so many were coming out specifically so they could homestead and farm. So presumably
they were farmers.
They were farmers, and they knew things about different animals, and they knew how to work the land, and they knew things about water. So it seems quite unlikely. Also, a lot of immigrants were coming to places because they already knew some family member, at least by the 1880s. We have so many foreign-born people in these Western towns that they were often coming to a place that they had already heard about. There was a family member there. Some of them were coming out to work mines. Some of them were coming to towns, or maybe going all the way west to cities. But a lot of them were coming out to be farmers and to get their own patch. So a lot of this complete haplessness seems very strange to us, and not necessarily accurate at all. At one point, you know, they talk about them not being able to swim, which I could certainly understand. There'd be people not knowing how to swim, but there is a scene in which they say they weren't allowed to swim. They were whipped and told not to.
In their country of origin.
In their country of origin. Yeah. And so crossing the river is going to be completely harrowing because of this, and we just have to dive in a little more there. And I'm not sure that I know of a place where people would have been punished for trying to learn how to swim. So we're gonna get back to you on that.
Yeah, we're gonna do a little more research on that. But and then the there is one woman who is Roma, and she is, you know, in every Western, going back,
pretty much every Western,
there is a woman who is usually a prostitute who has a heart of gold, and so you know you hear this And I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it because it's the stereotype.
It's the trope. It totally is.
Yeah,
yep.
It's the whore with the heart of gold.
Yep.
So in every Western, there is one. And we have ours in this series as well. And she is a Roma woman. She's a gypsy woman. And she is...
You can't mistake her because she's got the long, wavy, dark hair, yeah. off-the-shoulder dress, and a lot of traditional-looking jewelry jingling around her neck, right?
Yeah. And so we were, kind of sad to see that. That
because she's portrayed as a thief,
yeah.
and then because her husband dies, they portray her as, like, trying to turn every other man into her husband,
yeah.
but nobody wants anything to do with them, because mm-hmm. obviously if they're Roma or gypsies, then they're thieves.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely plays on a lot of those tropes in a couple of different ways. That was a little problematic. We're not sure it was even necessary.
No, I don't think
to the story at all.
Yeah. But some of these women, these immigrant women, are portrayed as powerful, independent women, and even Ilsa gets some ideas from them. She sees some of these women wearing pants, and then Ilsa, the main character of the story, decides she sees them and she's like, well, that's a good idea. I'm going to buy some pants from them. So she does go ahead and do that. But I guess this portrayal of immigrants is the other in this. And the costuming of the Roma, anyway, is a little bit over the top,
mm-hmm.
I would say. And mm-hmm. we looked at a lot of historical photographs of Roma who were living in the United States at this time, and I saw no off-the-shoulder outfits.
Mm.
And so I just wonder if they were using that off-the-shoulder outfit for this woman to really portray her as trying to be sexy or trying to be this
mm-hmm.
This loose woman.
It did lead to an interesting mm-hmm. moment where when she's talking to Tom, his character,
mm-hmm.
and he's saying, you don't want a black husband.
Yeah.
The government shouldn't be able to tell you who to love, but they do, sort of a nod to the miscegenation laws that prohibited certain people from marrying. But also that there are these degrees of freedom, he
mm-hmm.
tells her. And so, yes, there's this idea of freedom, which we'll dive into a little bit more. But there are these degrees, and not everybody is sort of equally free. And so mm-hmm. that was kind of an interesting nod
mm-hmm.
to the broader perspective as well through that character. So we're going to take a quick station break and then continue talking about 1883. You are listening to The Dirt on the Past with co-hosts Crystal Alegria and Nancy Mahoney on KGVM Bozeman or wherever you find your podcasts. We're talking today about the historical context of the Paramount Plus television series 1883, the prequel to Yellowstone, both of which were developed and written by Taylor Sheridan and are set in Montana. So I want to, before we move on from that, I want to kind of lean into some of the themes that are in there. And this theme comes up, but in a negative context to do with the immigrants, and that's that theme of leadership. We hear Sam Elliott's character constantly saying, "Who's your leader? Who's your leader? You need a leader. You don't have any leaders. You have, he's always getting so angry at the group of immigrants because he feels their role is to lead them, provide some protection and safety and guide, but that they need to police themselves and they need to have some organization and they need some cohesion. And so they need a leader for this. So it seems one of these themes that Sheridan is laying out there that is so important is, again, something we often associate with this idea of the American West, that leadership is very close to this idea of leading yourselves, being self-reliant. Are you the head of your family, the leader of your family? And if you don't have that leadership and self-reliance as a Western pioneer, you're not going to make it. And so until these immigrants can figure out who their leader is and really have that person show some leadership skills,
mm-hmm.
it seems like, they're doomed is what I think the implication is here. And the idea that maybe immigrants, because they're from other places, don't have that sense of how to come together and how to get behind a leader, and that this is a very American ideal and that these people are others and don't have them. So that might be me reading in and projecting. But one thing we do know is that by the end of episode 5, I think they say half of the group has perished.
Right.
From various ways, whether they're mishaps, accidents, violence,
rattlesnake,
all these things, right? So, and what we know from other historians who've looked at people, admittedly, it's not the same exact journey, but people who traveled out on the Oregon Trail, the pioneers, whether they were immigrant or American making that journey, 1 in 7 to 1 in 10 perished along the way. Whereas in this show, it's 1 in 2 have already perished, and they're not even halfway. They're not even out of Texas.
No, they're not even out of Texas.
So that also, I think, is heightening the danger, the drama, the banditry, the landscape, and it's the terror that it can hold. Being in this idea of a wilderness where, you know, it's such a difficult landscape that these people have no way of making it. It sounds like, again, that there he's taking some dramatic license, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think they lost about 5 in the river crossing. Oof, and that was,
There's so many other ways you could have done it, right? We won't go into it here.
We won't. But yeah. So I you're right. And, you know, kind of going back to that self-made man and that, you know, kind of bringing yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality. And, and, you know, there's a lot of that throughout this whole, and, you know, this manifest destiny, this idea of, you know, that they're conquering this landscape. It's a conquering, and especially with the Sam Elliott character, you know, it's I think that kind of ties in with that idea of leadership that you're talking about, is that he wants these immigrants to toughen up and conquer the landscape. Because that is what you do. You know?
He's almost like he's in a battle with the landscape.
Yeah.
And so the landscaping a character is, in this case, on this part of the journey anyway, it's something to be feared and conquered. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to battle it. Whereas, interestingly, Elsa's character really sees it differently.
Yeah.
At least to this point in it. She sees it as a place of wonder, a place of beauty, a place of freedom, which
freedom
is another of these themes that are coming up throughout all the episodes. And especially, is it in the 5th episode that they title it the Fangs of Freedom?
The Fangs of Freedom, yeah.
And we thought that this is a very interesting perspective that Sheridan is taking on freedom, because he doesn't talk about it in only a romantic sense. He allows us to see some of that through Elsa's eyes and the dream of being able to get to sort of a promised land where you could have a farm or the musician could set up in the city. But then there's also a lot of discussion, especially from Elsa's mother, about this is a double-edged sword.
Right.
Once you move away from these settled places where there's all these rules, yes, you have the freedom from those, but then there's other issues, there's other problems, and violence being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Choices that you have to make. There's always going to be issues with the choices you have to make, new responsibilities you have to have.
Mm-hmm. But Margaret definitely sees the freedom in this landscape that they're currently in. The freedoms from civilization. I'm doing air quotes right now. Civilization.
Yes.
You know, being a proper woman and really having etiquette and those sorts of things. You don't have to have some of that in this journey they're taking.
Yes, it's an opportunity, and she envies her daughter.
She envies her.
And the character, her sister-in-law, who didn't want to leave any of the etiquette and the rules and the idea of womanhood behind, she doesn't make it, right?
She does not.
She doesn't make it. So there's this theme there that you have to embrace this freedom, the dangers and everything that comes with it, the hardship, so that there's an upside to it, but only if you're willing to leave behind the trappings of civilization. But as we quickly find out, you know, the fangs are all these other dangers and other things that you have to address. And then, as we mentioned before, with Thomas, the idea of freedom is brought up to him, and he is saying, yes, but we're not all equally free. And every time the immigrants say, but it's a free country, but it's a free country, they always say, it doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
Back to them. So it's interesting that
not just Thomas,
right?
I mean, who doesn't have the freedoms as a black man, but even Shay Brennan says that.
Yeah.
That it doesn't work like that. This is, you know,
right.
So you know, what is Taylor Sheridan getting at with that? I'm curious.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see where that all mm-hmm. goes, because I don't think he's wrong about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that there's this wonderful core idea and ideal of freedom mm-hmm. in America that we often think the West embodies most obviously. And yet, we know there are so many people who are not free or don't all have the same freedoms. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, maybe opportunities, being mm-hmm. that there's only certain opportunities that are open to some mm-hmm. and not to everyone. Mm-hmm. So especially in this post-Civil War era, and especially out west, I think the other theme is we can't get away from is this idea that it's unsettled wilderness.
And they use the term wilderness over and over again, and untamed. Even in the trailer, they say that this is the last bastion of untamed America. And so that idea runs throughout. And of course, that means untamed, which means uncivilized, which means savage, you know?
Yes.
And so that, of course...
But also means unpopulated, not populated, and empty.
Empty. Which it was not empty, of course. As we all well know, this place had been occupied for at least 12,000 years, if not longer.
At least.
By large civilizations of people
and
nations of people. So, you know, that is lost.
Yes. That real important trope about wilderness and emptiness and it being empty land. We've discussed that on this program mm-hmm. a lot, how Yellowstone itself is not empty, just with Doug McDonald a little while ago. And so many people, this idea of wilderness has been a myth, and we're not excited to see that myth be perpetuated in the dialogue of these characters. And I don't feel that Sheridan has pushed back as much as he could about understanding the depth of occupation, the length of occupation, but also that these were places that even if tribes were on reservations, in theory at least, they still retained often within the treaty rights to hunt and fish mm-hmm. outside in the places that they were accustomed to. And that language is used over and over again for so many groups. So just understanding that these places aren't really empty and aren't wilderness mm-hmm. in the sense that empty of human occupation, they've been occupied for 10,000 years. And so there's evidence of those landscapes being used by Native people. So it may look empty to certain eyes, mm-hmm. but it isn't. And it wasn't.
And Elsa comments on that again mm-hmm. and again mm-hmm. about this untamed land, this open and beautiful unoccupied land. And so every time she says that, I think in my head, but it wasn't.
It wasn't. And I think, unfortunately, when you perpetuate that, that is actually what people see who come out here who don't mm-hmm. live here. That's what people see who come out to Yellowstone, because there isn't enough yet. We're hoping the Park Service kind of changes that mm-hmm. so it is more visible mm-hmm. to people so that they understand actually what they're seeing mm-hmm. as a Native homeland and not wilderness that was saved by the American government, you know, to be a park.
Yeah.
So let's move from that to the portrayal. Discuss the portrayal of Native Americans, which admittedly there hasn't been that much yet in the first five episodes.
Yeah. Kind of going back to that opening scene that we talked about for 1883. But also there was a flashback scene in Yellowstone.
That was the precursor to even the prequel that we're talking about. Exactly. And that was in one of the final episodes, mm-hmm. right? That they had a flashback within Yellowstone that actually shows you a little bit of what 1886 might have looked like or something.
Yeah. It was set in 1893.
That's right. Okay.
So the flashback is 1893, and it shows James Dutton, portrayed by Tim McGraw again, encountering a group of, we don't know what nation it is, but a group of Native American people who are coming onto his land to bury someone who has died. And so they have an interaction, this group of Native people with the Duttons, and they talk about whose land this is and whose land this was. And it's a really interesting exchange. And there's been some commentary on it, on how James Dutton is sitting up above this group of Native people on his horse in his big buffalo robe coat, and they're standing on the ground. And so it really sets up those ideas of who's in charge at this point in 1893.
They talk about it being a hard winter, and they talk about just wanting to put this elder in the place where they had desired to be buried. So it was a place that had been probably a part of their tribal lands before it became land that could be privately owned. And so they're requesting that Dutton give them permission. And he grants permission to them, and he also grants them a couple of cattle head that they could then slaughter and feed themselves with while they were doing ceremonies that they needed to do. So definitely sets up not an antagonistic relationship. There's some tension, but there's also this idea that they ask and he's giving. So I don't know if it's paternalistic, but either way, it's not setting up for any violence, but it's definitely setting up who has the power when you look at that.
There is definitely a power struggle there in the conversation. And it is clear who wins that struggle.
Absolutely.
It is not the Native people.
Absolutely. So we wanted to then dive into that there's this fictitious Indian reservation called the Broken Rock Indian Reservation, which is the one that borders, I believe, up onto the Yellowstone Ranch in the Yellowstone series. And so we're presuming that these tribal members that show up in the flashback are the ones that are ancestors of those people in the Yellowstone series, and that they're probably also from this Broken Rock Indian Reservation. And so for what we know geographically out here where we are in Bozeman and Montana and bordering, we're kind of surmising that Paradise Valley seems to be the place where the Dutton Ranch would be located. And I think even in some of the scenes from Yellowstone, they talk about Paradise Valley. And that's real valley south of Livingston that does border right up on Yellowstone National Park. And there are plenty of cattle ranchers out there, Nelson Story and his family being one of them,
that's where they settled.
Cattle ranches out there, even though he also, you know, had a home here in Bozeman and business here in Bozeman. That was the place where they had a big ranch, and it is an amazingly beautiful valley at the base of the Absorkies and leading into Yellowstone. So you have wolves that come in and out, bison, elk that migrate in and out, and so you have certain tensions over that in the present day. But that seems to be where the fictitious Dutton Ranch would be located. And then we're assuming, you know, the closest tribe to where that area is in reality would be the Crow Reservation.
So, and of course, the Crow Nation lands reservation is not close to Paradise Valley. It's
not anymore.
It once was. It once was bordering kind of up against the what we now call the Paradise Valley. At one point, it was part of the Paradise Valley at one point. But of course, over time, that after treaties, after the 1851 treaty, after the 1868 treaty, those lands started to diminish.
Yeah.
And so the current reservation is about 100 miles from Paradise Valley.
Yeah. So by 1882 or so, the border had been by big timber along the Yellowstone. So it had been all the way farther west, but then it shrunk again after that. So we're way farther over south of Billings, around the Hardin area. So today that reservation is much smaller. So originally, before that, by that first treaty in the 1850s, their land covered vast territory in Wyoming, and all of Yellowstone National Park would have been in there, and all that place up to the Yellowstone River. So originally that was the lands that they were granted, and then they kept ceding it in order for goods that were promised to them to be delivered, and then a lot of those goods never really were delivered, and the promises were never kept, but the reservation did shrink and become the hard borders that we see today. But so it's not as close as it was, but so we think sort of the Crow Reservation is where you would think that's what's being substituted by the Indian Rock Reservation in the series, and that those might have been Crow Indians, and perhaps Sheridan didn't pick Crow because he didn't want to have to worry too much about historical accuracy or sensitive portrayals or things like that.
Right,
which we can understand.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think that you know, that's it's hard to watch Yellowstone as a Montana person, or as a person who lives in Montana, because of course, you know, he's portraying these things fictitiously, but you want to equate it to what's here today, you know. So when things happen in the series Yellowstone, it's very different than here, you know. It's hard to see it and it's hard to watch it. So
right. I just hope that, I mean, I'm interested to see the portrayal once the Duttons actually arrive. Because so far, all we have is that opening scene that's very violent. We don't know what tribe that is supposed to be necessarily. And we know that by the time the Duttons would have arrived in 1883 in Bozeman, in Paradise Valley, or all around there, we know what was going on with the Crow historically. Right. So as you said, they would have already been at the second agency.
Which was over near what is now Absarokee, Montana. So that's where they would have been, which is quite a ways away.
Quite a ways away and quite diminished in terms of their ability to move around. And they were also a group that was very friendly to settlers. They often traded. They're not one of the tribes. The Blackfeet in this area were much more known for being groups that might have more antagonistic, violent interactions with settlers. And so the Crow were known more even by the fort, the people inhabiting the fort at Fort Ellis. They were regularly interacting in a much more friendly manner and trading. So I'm interested to see how they'll be portrayed as we get into those last episodes.
Yeah. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, so we want to talk a little bit more about what else the Duttons would have seen once they finally get to Montana.
So if they're coming, you know, we don't know how this all plays out in Taylor Sheridan's world, but we assume that they're going to make it to Montana in 1883 at some point. So what they would be coming into, they would be coming, of course, it wasn't a state yet. It was just Montana Territory in 1883.
Right.
It had become a territory. Montana Territory had become Montana Territory in 1864. And so Bozeman was founded during that same year in 1864. And Livingston, which they talk about in the series, Yellowstone every once in a while as well, wasn't even created until about the time that the Duttons were coming through, which was 1883.
Right. So the park was created in 1872 was the National Park. But Livingston wasn't really a place at all. So Bozeman would have been the nearest
place.
Town.
Yep. Right. So as the Duttons were coming in here, Bozeman would have been kind of the only town in the area. And in 1880, the census of Bozeman was 894 people. So it was fairly small. It was a fairly small little town. And there was quite a diverse group of people living in Bozeman at that point. There was a lot of people who had been foreign-born, who had been born in Eastern and Northern Europe, who had traveled, immigrated into Bozeman. We have a large German contingency living here in Bozeman. A lot of them owned and operated breweries here.
Fantastic,
in town.
Yeah.
And they were farmers.
Yeah.
We also had a group of Black African American community members here in Bozeman at that time, about 21 people. Mm-hmm. We also had a Chinese community here in Bozeman, about 20 or 21 people living here in Bozeman in 1880. So, you know, we definitely had, it was a really interesting mix. I always think about walking down the street in Bozeman in 1880, and you'd hear all these different languages
all
being
these
spoken.
Different,
you'd hear German, Swedish, you'd hear Chinese, you'd hear really deep Southern drawls, you'd hear people from Britain, you'd hear people from the East Coast. So it would have been a really interesting place to see in 1883 to come into. And of course, in 1883, that's a big year for Bozeman, actually, because the railroad had finally made its way here in 1883. So in March of 1883, the railroad comes through, and that's huge for this town because Bozeman was founded as more of an agricultural supply depot.
Yeah, the whole Gallatin Valley just being such a place for farming and ranching.
In agriculture. Yep. So it was a place that was founded to provide food to Virginia City and Helena and some of these other gold rush towns. And so, but of course, then the gold rush towns dwindled, and Bozeman didn't really know what it was going to do to make a living for a long time. And it really depended on the government supplying goods to some of these Indian agencies, specifically the Crow Indian Agency.
Right. And before that, it was Fort Ellis. By playing up the threat of Native Americans between the 1860s, towards the end of the 1860s, they were able to secure a fort. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where they left off of to go explore Yellowstone and eventually map it and make it a park. But that fort needed to be supplied with a lot of stuff.
Food.
Now, we know all the men there, and also the women who did the laundry and all the, I mean, that was a huge moneymaker. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of going back and forth, even marriages that happened between, but a lot of those people, again, were foreign born who were working at the fort and serving at the fort. Yeah. So that was a big boon to Bozeman until the railroad came through.
Yeah. And so they thought the railroad was going to come through in 1873. It didn't. There was a huge economic collapse in our nation in that year. And so when the railroad came through in 1883, it was huge. It was, made it possible for the Bozeman ranchers and farmers to get their goods out to the rest of the country and continue supporting Bozeman and helping it to grow into what it is today.
So. Yeah, and it made it possible for people to settle just more of the lands around here all along the way through Montana. So Montana, we know in the 1880s, from some of the immigrant and census population, we know in 1880 the state itself, about 30%, so pretty much one in three people who were white were foreign born. So that doesn't even include non-white people and people who were Chinese that came in here and worked on the railroads and stayed. But one in three white people were foreign born, which means there were a lot of immigrants here. And we were also talking back to our discussion about immigrants that so many people had already settled here from 1860 on. We had so many immigrants in all of these towns in the Rockies and along the Great Plains and out west that, again, the portrayal of these really hapless immigrants to us seems not accurate. And we would have had a lot of people who would have been following other family members. But just before we leave this picture we've painted of what Bozeman might have looked and sounded like, just talk a little bit about that red light district that we know would have been here.
Yeah, it was a thriving red light district in the 1880s, and it really got its start in the 1880s and kind of this time when the Duttons would have been coming in 1883. That's when this Bozeman red light district was really forming and becoming a solidified.
I mean, the founding
thing.
Fathers of Bozeman were building the brothel that we're sitting in, recording in right now, you know, and it eventually became property of the Story family. So that kind of ties into this whole really, I wish it would be fun to see if any of that kind of diversifying of their family business comes through at all.
I did know that they showed quite a few ladies of the evening in Fort Worth.
In Fort Worth,
when
for
they
sure.
started, and they had all the same kind of costume.
Yes,
outfit.
They did.
I don't know how accurate that was.
Exactly. That'll be interesting to see if Bozeman is actually portrayed at all as we go forward. So that's been really fun for us to kind of take a look ahead and see what we might see once they actually show up here.
To see what Bozeman looks like.
What Bozeman looks like, and then will there be another season after this one? So there's a lot. There'll be maybe a lot more to talk about. So we're excitedly awaiting our chance to view the next five episodes.
And they might not get to Montana in this next season or in these next five episodes. You know, this might go on for three or four or five seasons like Yellowstone
has. I'm fascinated to see if we find out how they acquired all their land, and that sort of thing. So that will be wonderful. We kind of wanted to follow up by just, saying that, again, we've seen some other more recent Westerns that provide a different perspective that dives into the more complicated groups of people that and perspectives that really formed the communities in the West. So we're really leaving behind Frederick Jackson Turner, who in 1893 published that the frontier was closing and started a whole new, basically, history of the West, where he says this was where the real America, where democracy was really born, was out in the West. And when he talks about the frontier closing, he's really talking about Montana and the Dakotas, because those were the last places where we had Indians settled on reservations. Those were the last places where we had enough settlement that you had populations above this very sparse level, where you could say there was really no more. So it was an interior frontier was the last frontier in the American West, because we already had people out in California in the 1840s and up into Oregon. So this idea that the American character was born in the West, and this ideal of democracy and everybody helping, I think subsequently historians have really changed our understanding. We have Patty Limerick with Legacy of Conquest, understanding the extraction economy of all of the resources in the West, the conquest of native lands and taking over of places really was a huge factor in building the West. Mm-hmm. And then since then, the historians have really tried to include in this whole other story of understanding post-Civil War, what happened after Reconstruction, and the really varied groups of people and immigrants that were settled out here and the contributions they made. So we were kind of hoping for a little bit more of that, or just at least a little bit more complex understanding. So movies like Hostiles, Power of the Dog, The Harder They Fall, some of those Monsters perspectives
that we've seen more recently.
Yeah, we'd love to see a little bit of turning away from these tropes and myths.
These stereotypes and
about,
myths. And really kind of looking at the West in a much, it's, you know, I always think that the true story is always much more interesting.
Much more interesting.
And, you know, to look at this complexity, I think would be fascinating.
And
we want Westerns to do that, because we're kind of tired of the old
stereotypes. We're just going to have to write one, Crystal. What's going to have to happen. Okay, so we have a lot more we could comment on, but I think that's it for this episode. We're going to wrap it up.
Yep. And so if you love this podcast, please tell a friend. Go on to Spotify or Apple podcasts and leave a review. We would love to have that. And thanks to all of you out there for listening today. And we hope you can join us again to find out more about
The Dirt on the Past. And a big thank you to our editor and sound guru, Steve Durbin. Thanks to Lawson Alegria for mixing the music, and to John Chadwell for helping getting this podcast.